From rocking with the boss to fighting apartheid and starring in one of the most beloved and respected TV shows of all time, The Sopranos, he can claim one of the most eclectic, wide-ranging, and memorable careers in entertainment. And now, Stevie Van Zandt is sharing his life on stage and on screen and everything in between in the new memoir, Unrequited Infatuations. And what a pleasure it is to welcome its author, the legend Stevie Van Zandt, to Frank Buckley Interview. Stevie, welcome, sir. Great to have you.
Good to be with you, Frank.
Thank you. Your career spans generations of fans. It spans different mediums. It literally spans continents. But it starts, as many music careers do, with you listening to records in your bedroom as a kid. Was there a particular artist or band that made you think, I want to be like them?
Well, yeah. I was buying singles here and there for a while, a couple of years. And then the big bang, as I refer to it, was the Beatles appearing on a variety show called Ed Sullivan. The whole family would watch it every Sunday night. And, you know, he'd have something for every age group, puppets for the kids and opera for the older folks. And the thing that for the teenagers that night was the Beatles. And it really blew my mind and you know, 72 million others. But it really did change the culture into a band culture, which didn't exist in our country. You know, we had you know, doo-wop groups, and we had instrumental groups, and we had individuals, you know, Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley and Little Richard. But we didn't have a lot of 4 and 5 guys playing and singing. It wasn't a thing, really, especially at that time. So all of a sudden, there wasn't one single band the day before, and the day after, literally everybody had a band in the garage, and I was soon to be one of them.
You know? Yeah, and you know, to think of where you are today, Stevie, and compared to that kid, that teenager who hears the Beatles and thinks that has changed the world, did you ever think in a million years, or maybe you did, that you would be where you are today?
Well, no, you couldn't imagine. I had a pretty good imagination, but not that good. the struggle was just, it's hard to describe how new the whole idea was. I mean, it wasn't even a business until the 70s. Not really, you know. So it was just a bunch of freaks, you know, trying to find their identity and find a way to make a living doing it, because which seemed like an impossible dream, just that.
Yeah.
Not to be famous necessarily, but just to try and make a living doing it was almost impossible.
You use the word freaks, and you use that in your book as well. You talk about the fact that even when you met Bruce Springsteen, you were both long-haired guys from working class neighborhoods in New Jersey, and you say you were freaks, and that somehow when you met as teenagers, there was sort of a natural sort of friendship that developed because you were these guys who were sort of outliers. But the one thing that struck me was when you met, you guys are both legends now. When you meet as teenagers, the angels didn't cry, the heavens didn't open up. It was just a couple of guys. You barely remember the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I do remember the moment, but it was no big deal. Like I said, it was a, you know, most of the band stayed in the garage mercifully, but about a dozen of us got out, and you knew them all. You know, I mean, you knew all the other bands because there was not that many of them, and I think what bonded us even closer was on Saturdays I go on the bus up to New York and see bands in the afternoon at the Cafe Y, which is still there. And those bands were like a year ahead of us in New Jersey. So you'd go, you know, and you would observe, you know, and try and steal some ideas and use them in your band. And I started running into Bruce doing the same thing, right. You know, which was quite unusual. I mean, it's, you know, it's an hour and 15 minutes away, which was a big deal when you were a kid. And so I think we started to realize we're the only other guy we knew who really took it seriously, and it was not like a hobby or a thing on the weekends. Rock and roll was everything to us. And it helped having one other guy feel the same way. You know, if you're the only one, you know, maybe there's something wrong with you. But if there's two of you, you know, maybe you're onto something.
And I can't remember if this was coming home from one of those instances or another situation, but you write about the fact that at one point you guys were walking by, I think it was your dad, or maybe it was his dad in the kitchen, and just sort of looking off into space. And you describe how both of your fathers, in a way, were, I don't know if the word was ashamed of you or upset that you were what you guys became, I mean, at the moment. Can you take us into that moment, and why did they feel that way, and how did that end up in terms of your relationships with your fathers?
Yeah, ashamed is the correct word. Ashamed and embarrassed. And, we were literally two of the only guys with long hair in those days, which I know it seems like nothing now, but in those days, you just didn't have long hair. There was something wrong with you if you had long hair.
Right.
And they were worried that we were going to be drug addicts. I think my parents would have, preferred me to be a criminal. At least it was steady work, you know. But this wasn't something that they could relate to. It just wasn't. That generation, I mean, we were the generation gap that people talk about, which I thought would be the biggest generation gap in history. But I think we're actually going through another one right now, actually. It's just more subtle. Mm. But in those days, it was open warfare. And, we would, of course, reconcile with both of our fathers in a few years. But at first, man, it was tough going. And I ended up getting thrown out of the house, got thrown out of school. It was rough. It was a tough time.
Mm. When I told friends that I was speaking to you, they wanted me to ask you how the music came together. And I had Bernie Taupin on this program once, and he talked to me about writing with Elton John. He would write the lyrics. Elton John would take the words, sit down at a piano, and bang it out, sometimes in 20 minutes. Your great collaboration with Bruce Springsteen over the years, how did it start, and then how did it work as you guys worked together?
Well, we're basically going through the 60s, which was largely, surprisingly, a monoculture in a sense, year by year, for us in the music world. It would only happen in the 60s, but 64, all British invasion, 65, all folk rock, you know, like that. And I go into great detail in the book about it. But basically, as you went through each trend, you would pick up something, you know, you'd learn something from it. It was kind of like going to school, and it would go through each individual trend. You'd learn something from that, you know, from folk rock, then something from blues rock. Everybody was playing blues for a while. Then it was psychedelic, you know, then it was country rock. Everybody played country music for a minute, you know, and some would stay in that genre. But most of us would kind of pick what we liked from it and just keep moving, building our identity. And then we just by the end of the 60s, we just were having a different band every 3 months. You know, we just have something different. Try this, we try that. So you're constantly building your identity that way until really all the way until Bruce gets signed to a record label following the trend of that moment, which was in the early 70s, happened to be singer-songwriters, came to be the popular trend. Thanks to, I think, the Beatles signing James Taylor really started that off, I think, somewhere, you know, and, you know, they had Jackson Browne, we had, Carole King and quite a few others being signed. You know, it was like a modern version of what we used to call folk music. The only difference between these singer-songwriters all had hit records, you know, but Bruce kind of got signed under that in that Trojan horse,
right?
You know,
but in terms of artistic vision, you guys weren't always on the same page, right? And so, how did you decide, hey, I want to try this, or, you know, let's go with this, or I'm going to write the lyrics, or you're going to write the music? How did that get, that workload get divided?
Well, we didn't collaborate all that much in terms of writing. The only songs we really did that would be for Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. We did three songs, or, you know, so for Southside. But other than that, we kind of wrote on our own, and we would just have different bands. Some days I would be the leader. Sometimes he'd be the leader. We had a country guy. He was the leader. You know, Southside might be the leader. I mean, we just took turns having different types of bands. So it wasn't like collaborating in a true sense as much as just being in each other's bands.
Yeah.
Until he got signed.
And for 15 years, you guys grind, and you're putting out music, and then you get really to the top of your game, and you decide to walk away from it. We're going to take a short break. When we get back, more with Stevie Van Zandt. We're going to ask him why he walked away from the band.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
And we're back with Stevie Van Zandt, who's written this terrific book, Unrequited Infatuations. Stevie, you're just talking about the fact that you and Bruce Springsteen, you have this great collaboration. You've been working for so many years. You finally get to essentially the top. You're about to enjoy the fruits of all your labor. And you decide to leave, to walk away from it. What led up to that, and why'd you do it?
Well, it wasn't because I was a genius when it came to my career. It's a perfect storm of a number of things, which, you know, I go into great detail about. But let's just say for now, it was my obsession with politics had taken place. I started to read about our foreign policy since World War II, and was shocked to find that we were not the heroes of democracy around the world like I thought we were, like I was brought up to think by my ex-Marine Goldwater Republican father. And, you know, slowly I just kind of became obsessed with it and wanted to talk about it. And a number of other things, but basically I decided to leave.
Yeah. Let me share this quote from the book, because it speaks to what happened when you did. You said, upon leaving the band, I became persona totally non grata. We didn't publicize any bad blood, not one negative word from either of us. We just said that I'd left to pursue my own career. But I was seen as a traitor by virtually everybody. People felt they had to choose sides. Guess whose side they chose? I didn't think I had much in common with Trotsky, but we were both temporarily written out of history. That must have been such a dark and difficult moment for you in your life.
Yeah, it didn't hit me right away because there was a lot of emotions involved. We were kind of having an argument about something anyway. And so it took a minute for it to actually sink in. Which happened on my flight to South Africa, actually, to do that research. And I remember the moment it happened. I realized, wow, I just I've been working for 15 years towards this moment, and I've just blown my life. And I never was a good flyer. I was always nervous on planes, and I felt the fear just completely leave my body at that moment. And I've been, you know, fearless ever since. But it was one of those things that you didn't think about too much. It was just a lot of, like, a hurricane of emotions happening. And then when the air cleared, I realized that I was starting from scratch, a whole new life. And that's where the book, I think, starts to get more interesting in a way. I mean, the first half of the book is you know, great. You know, local kid from Jersey makes it to the top of rock and roll. And that's a good story, you know, by itself. But the second half is where the bigger themes start to appear. And I wanted it to be more than a music book for music people. I wanted it to be a bit more universal than that. And the themes of searching for one's identity and searching for purpose, you know, searching for spiritual enlightenment, you know, some direction, some form of usefulness. I think these are more common themes, and they start to happen in the second half of the book.
And
where I'm just like, you know, no plan at all.
Do you think that they also happened in the second half of your life? And do you think that you have found some of those things and the peace that maybe you were seeking?
Yeah, I think I'm hoping the book ends up being useful and maybe even inspirational in one simple way. I've accomplished everything I've accomplished in the world, pretty much, since I thought my life ended. You know, I thought my life was over at that point. But everything I've done has happened since. You know, I became an artist in my 30s and did 7 albums now. I became an actor in my 40s, did Sopranos and Lilyhammer. You know, I mean, I got, you know, into politics, and we got Mandela out of jail and brought down a South African government.
Oh,
and,
is know, that all?
You know, well, I'm just saying that, you know, these are the things that I did not plan on. And when you look back at your whole life, you think, wow, you know, the things I didn't plan on, the things that happened after I thought my life was over, is when destiny spoke and said, you know, you're not done yet, man. You got other things, you know, out here to do. And I hope people can maybe get something from that. You know, that when they experience disappointment and frustration, and maybe, you know, their original plan for their life has ended, you know, they should, you know, I hope if they read this book, they'll realize, man, you know, maybe it's not over. You know, maybe there's more to come. So if you can find a way to move forward, and you don't, you know, don't let it stop you, don't become a drug addict or an alcoholic or commit suicide, all of which occurred to me. You know, if you can find a way to keep moving forward and just, you know, do your best to realize your potential or whatever it is, you'll be surprised. You know, destiny may surprise you.
That will inspire people. I have no doubt about it. Stevie, you touched on the acting. You touched on the Sopranos. Let me just show a short clip from the iconic TV series.
I'm going to tell you something I never told anybody. Back when Jackie was at the end, he floated the idea of me stepping up to the big seat. Not Tony. Me.
Really?
Yeah. But I thought, it's not for me.
Still, you wouldn't sneeze at it.
I never saw myself as that kind of guy. Now I'm more behind the scenes. Advice. Strategy.
But here you are still. The times make the man, honey. Not the other way around.
Stevie, you were so good in The Sopranos. And I was shocked to learn you really didn't have formal acting training when you played Silvio Dante, the consigliere to Tony Soprano. How did you have the confidence to step up with guys who had incredible acting chops and then to pull it off in the way that you did?
Yeah. I'd watch my wife, who was a real actor. That was my wife in that scene, my real wife, Maureen playing Gabriella. You know, she I'd watched her go to classes for years and do off-Broadway. And, you know, I'd seen what a real actor goes through. That's why when David Chase finally offered me the job, I said, you know, I feel guilty taking an actor's job. These guys work all the time. I watch what my wife goes through. And he said, okay, I'll tell you what, then I'll write you in a part that doesn't exist. So we, you know, we wrote in the Silvio Dante part, and I wrote a biography about the guy just for my own use, really, and I shared it with the writers just for the heck of it. But he was, you know, tough guy, fearless guy, growing up with, you know, friendly with Tony Soprano all his life. And we just started from there. And I knew if I could look in the mirror and see the guy, I could be the guy, you know. To this day, I don't know how actors act looking like themselves. I think that's quite a challenge, and I have nothing but respect for the profession, you know. But for me, I needed to see somebody else. Oh. And that's what happened. And, you know, so I came out of that trailer as a tough guy, you know, and I just stayed in that role. And I think David Chase picked up on the relationship between me and Jimmy in that first season. We bonded on the basis of us both being kind of character actors, him a character actor, me a side man. Mm. You know, neither one of us inclined necessarily to be the front guy, to be the star.
Yeah.
But we both had experience suddenly being thrust into the spotlight and having to rise to the occasion. So I think we bonded on that basis, and then. And then I slowly became the underboss and consigliere in the family, you know, just from, I think, me and Jimmy's natural relationship with each other.
And you're talking about the great late James Gandolfini, who was such an amazing actor. I want to get back to something you said a moment ago, and you talked about the fact that you were sort of a genius with regard to managing your career early on, and the fact that and you put that in the context of leaving the band. At what point after that plane trip to South Africa, when you get back to the U.S., is it a moment of, now what? What am I going to do? Why did I do that? Was there a lot of self-reflection, or did you just get right back to work?
No, once I realized my life that I'd worked 15 years for was over, I was all in with the political situations as I was encountering them, beginning with South Africa. I went a little deeper with the research into some dangerous places. Mm-hmm. Because of that fearlessness of, you know, what are they going to do? Kill me? You know, do me a favor? You know, mm-hmm. that kind of attitude.
Yeah.
Oh no! When I got back, I was all in, and we started. I was fortunate enough to. It became the Four Musketeers, me, Danny Schechter, who did all the publicity for it, Arthur Baker, whose phone book and studio and musicians made the thing happen, and Hart Perry, who, if he hadn't filmed it, none of it would have happened because no radio station would play Sun City. So we had to make a great video for people to even be aware of it.
Yeah.
I was all in, and we organized. We ended up having 50 artists on it, and it was a really, really clear victory, which is rare in international liberation politics.
Yeah.
You know, you gain an inch here, you gain an inch there, but you never have a complete victory like we did. It was really extraordinary.
You talked in the book about getting back together with Bruce at some point. I think you said it was a couple of years later. And he said, didn't he say to you, I know you'd never get back to me, that you'd never come to me to make this happen, so I'm coming to you. Is that the way it happened? And was it awkward when you guys finally thought, all right, let's put it behind us?
Yeah, we actually reconciled pretty quickly. I mean, I put in our three biggest fights we've ever had in our lives. I put all three in the book and you know, in some detail. And but we reconcile very quickly when that happens. I think our bond is extremely strong coming from when we were kids and when we really sort of needed each other at a time when there wasn't a whole lot of other people having faith in what we were doing, but we had faith in each other. And I think that kind of bond lasts a lifetime. I mean, it's still, you know, we're still best friends to this day. Mm. So we recovered quickly from those things, you know. And I was a bit more extreme than he was emotionally, I guess. So that's why he said, you know, if I don't call you, you're never going to call me again. who knows?
You mentioned earlier that with James Gandolfini, that the two of you felt like guys who were the character actors, that you weren't supposed to be the star, the front man. That's a theme, yeah, obviously, that goes through back to the music as well. I mean, you're a mega talent with Bruce Springsteen, but you let him be effectively the front guy. And is that out of choice? And as you're in that role, are you thinking, hey, I should be that guy? Or do you feel most comfortable in that role?
No, no, that's without a doubt my inclination. I started off as a front man. You know, I led my own bands, and I was good at it. And I got good at it again in the 80s when I left the E Street Band and did those five solo albums in the 80s. I became a very good front man again. Mm-hmm. But it's never been my my natural inclination. I just I think you know to be a real front man, a real superstar, a real celebrity. I think you have to need that spotlight. You have to need that adulation from the audience, you know, to really complete you. I really believe that, you know, for whatever reason, you know, we can analyze it all day long. But basically, and I do analyze it in a book, but it's not something that I just felt I've ever needed. So I prefer to be off to the side or behind or even just a producer writer. I'm fine with that, you know. Performance is something that, you know, I enjoy. It's a lot of fun. It's like a vacation. But it's not, you know, the most satisfying part of my life. The satisfying part, the real realizing your potential part is the creation, the creative part, you know, writing and producing, you know, and then, you know, whether it's an acting or whether it's, you know, playing on stage, that's the fun part to me. That's, you know, anytime I don't have to think, it's a vacation.
But isn't it because you put in the time and you spent the hours and the days and the so much time, and you sort of reference it in the book about how you knew this early on. You wanted to have that Beatles experience in Hamburg, right? Where you're putting in the hours, putting, you know, 6 or 7 days a week in front of crowds, so that by the time you get to where you are today, it is just fun.
That's right. You're exactly right. You got to put that work in, and the Beatles were the best example of it. Literally 6 sets a night. 7 nights a week for months at a time. No one will ever work harder than that. Okay, so, you know, it's justice that they ended up the biggest thing in the world. They earned it, you know.
As did you, and I just wonder, do you ever take a moment to say, you know what? Yeah, I did earn this. I'm where I am because I put in the work.
Yeah, no one's ever given me anything. You know, right. I never received a thing from anybody. I you know, yeah, I earned everything I've ever done. And I, you know, and that's how it should be. You know, I didn't ask for anything and nobody was offering, you know. you know, I mean, it was just one of those things that, you know, I mean, it sounds harsh, but sometimes kids will come up to you and say, you know, or a parent will say, you know, what advice can you give to my kid? You know, and once in a while, if I feel in a truthful mood, you know, I say to them, if your kid needs advice, he's not going to make it. Because nobody was encouraging us. Nobody. Okay.
Right.
You know, and that's what it takes. It's a little bit Darwinian, granted, and I have an entire school education program to help that situation out called teachrock.org. And, you know, we're teaching music history to kids so they will be enthusiastic about music and other things. So we are, you know, we are trying to help out in that way. But the truth of the matter is, you know, if you're looking for encouragement in this world, you know, you're not going to make it. I mean, if you need that encouragement, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
You got to do it because you have to. You know, I had no plan B in my life. You know, we were freaks, misfits, outcasts. You know, we were just, you know, I didn't want to go to college. I didn't want to go to the military. I was too small for sports. And there was no job that interested me. Thank God the Beatles came along when they did. And also, I must say, thank God 4 months later, the Rolling Stones came, because the Beatles were so good when we first saw them. They were, you know, halfway through the career. They started in 57, gone in 69. We catch them in 64 when they were extremely sophisticated. I mean, the harmony was perfect. The hair, the clothes, everything was amazing, you know. So they kind of revealed the new world. But then the Rolling Stones come 4 months later, and, you know, they're kind of more casual, wearing what they want, and then no harmony, really. and they, you know, they were kind of like the first punk band in a sense. And And it made it look easier than it was.
Yeah.
And so they you know, the way I like to put it is the Beatles create, you know, the Beatles revealed this new world to us and the Rolling Stones invited us in.
Ah. Last question. With all that you've accomplished, the acting, the activism, the music, is there one that you are most satisfied with, most happy about, that you think that's my body of work that I most want to be known for, or is it all of it?
Well, there's a few things, you know. There is. I mean, the music history curriculum, teachrock.org, I think is going to be my most important contribution. My two radio formats, which I created, both on a Sirius satellite, I think are two very important formats that will live on beyond me. Probably the Sun City Project, you know, will be the most important thing I've ever done politically. Would the South African government have fallen inevitably? Probably, yeah, but we took years off of its life for sure. Mm. And got Mandela out of jail when he was still coherent, which was extremely important. So, you know, I think those things I think will live on, you know, will live on beyond me, and I'm proud of them.
All right, one more short break. Continue our conversation with actor, activist, musical artist, Stevie Van Zandt.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And we're back with actor, activist, and musician Stevie Van Zandt. Stevie Van Zandt, you've done it all. You're at the age of 39. What is left to do? I mean, what is the next phase of your creative endeavor and your journey?
More of the same. I'd like to get back on TV. I missed it. You know, I'd even go back to Lilyhammer if Netflix wanted to. I love that show. I also like to keep the Disciples of Soul together. My band, we just did two new albums these last couple of years and had the most productive years of my life. But if Bruce wants to go out next year with the E Street Band, I'm going to give him a first priority. So if he wants to go out and the virus cooperates, I'd like to do that.
Oh, well, we hope that happens. And we sure hope you'll make that tour come through Southern California. Stevie, thank you so much for coming on the program.
My pleasure, Frank.
And once again, the book is Unrequited Infatuations. Stevie, I can't tell you how much fun I've had doing this. Thank you so much, sir. Hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And if you're not a subscriber, I hope you'll do it today. It's free, of course, and it'll ensure that you won't miss a single episode of our podcast, which drops every week on Wednesday. We have some 240 episodes in our archives that you can listen to at any time on demand. You can also see our interviews on KTLA on the weekends and on YouTube. As always, thanks for sharing us on social media with your friends. Tag me when you do. I'm Frank Buckley TV on Twitter and on Instagram. Thanks for listening, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.